am leaving soon. And you will forgive me if I speak bluntly. The universe grows smaller every day. And the threat of aggression by any group, anywhere, can no longer be tolerated. For our policemen, we created a race of robots. The penalty for provoking their action is too terrible to risk. It is no concern of ours how you run your own planet. But if you threaten to extend your violence, this earth of yours will be reduced to a burned-out cinder.
I'm Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Join us as we explore the deep heritage of science fiction and fantasy, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Welcome aboard! Welcome to Retro Rockets. Cora, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm Cora Bulat. I'm from Bremen in North Germany. I'm a translator and teacher in my day job. I'm a blogger and a reviewer and review a lot of old science fiction, both on my personal blog and for Galactic Journey. And I'm also a three-time Hugo finalist for Best Fan Writer.
Congratulations. What are your websites? Where can we find you online?
You can find my blog at www.corabulert, that's corabulert.com, or at galacticjourney.org. I don't think I need to spell that. It's because it's quite simple. And at Galactic Journey, of course, you can find a lot of reviews of vintage science fiction, because we are like any other science fiction fanzine. We cover the magazines, the books, the movies, the TV shows, and also the science and regular everyday news, but of 55 years in the past. So now it's 1967. Star Trek has just concluded its first season, and the Summer of Love is about to start up in the US, and in Germany, the 1960s, and in Europe in general, the 1960s are about to get a lot less peaceful with student protests ending in violence.
I got to go catch up on a lot of reading on Galactic Journey, it sounds like.
Yeah, so I think it would be right up your alley.
I agree. Congratulations on your Hugo nomination for Best Fan Writer. What does it feel like to be a Hugo nominee?
Well, it's an amazing feeling. The first time it felt quite unreal, because you get this email and there's maybe 2 or 3 weeks where you can't really tell anybody. And also the email the first time I got it in 2020, it was right at the start of the COVID pandemic. And I was at home and I was waiting for 2 important emails, which hadn't arrived. And there was an email from Consilient. And it was something, it was titled like Consilient Confidential, Hugo Confidential or something. I think like, oh, that's probably the convention newsletter. So I ignored, but the important emails hadn't arrived. So I said like, oh, well, let's look at the newsletter since I'm here anyway. And I'm a Hugo finalist, because I didn't expect to get it that year. I didn't expect it. And it felt a bit unreal, because I know I'm not the only one, because other first-time finalists have told me the same. The first time around, it feels like, oh, there's probably been some terrible mistake. They accidentally emailed the wrong person, or, oh, I'm only here because all 20 people would have been ahead of me have withdrawn. Because I think I was like number 10 on the long list the year before, so I didn't expect to move up all that much. Yes, and the second and third time, it's easier to enjoy, and simply because by then you know, okay, it's not a fluke, and you're not, it's not a mistake, and yes, so it's a great feeling, and it's amazing. I just hope I could actually go to the one of the cons, well, because it looks extremely unlikely that I'll manage to go to ChiCon, because the pandemic is still ongoing, and I have to say my mother is sick, and I'm not sure if I can leave her alone, if she will be well enough by then that I can leave her and my dad alone. So yes, that's a bit unfortunate.
That is unfortunate. I hope there's more virtual options for ChiCon.
Yeah, they have a virtual membership. ChiCon has a virtual membership, and for DisCon, we were, and I think also probably this year, we would have been able to accept virtually if I'd won, but then I didn't. But Bogi Takac and Elsa Sionis, both of whom do great work, won. And yes, but I hope they'll see. And of course, Shycon also has quite a lot of they have quite a bit of programming on older science fiction also, which I like. I hope some of it will be virtual, so I can enjoy it.
I hope they do a virtual option for all of the programming.
Yes, it might be a bit expensive. I don't know. It's probably a cost thing because streaming is, of course, expensive. And it's, I mean, at least for the programming, which makes sense. A painting workshop or something doesn't make sense to have it on, virtual. But everything else could be done virtual. But everything that can be done virtually.
Yeah, like four or five authors doing a panel conversation, or two people interviewing each other. Like, I would hope that those would have virtual options. Mm-hmm. But anything, I know I've seen at conventions like stage combat demonstrations, like that doesn't make sense to do virtually.
No, it doesn't make sense. You need to see that info.
Yeah.
Of course, you could always record it, but and they sometimes do. But I think there's also privacy concerns and everything. Someone doesn't want to be recorded. So yes, we'll see how much virtual. They say they're committed to a lot of virtual programming. So let's hope we'll get that. Let's hope it will become standard, because I think a lot of us won't be traveling to Chengdu next year.
Mm-hmm. And it's oftentimes for travel, there's even outside of the pandemic, there's the expense. For a lot of families, travel just isn't realistic. Who's gonna watch your kids? Who's gonna watch your dog? So with some kind of virtual option being permanent, I think it allows for so many more people to participate and attend. I personally won't be traveling to Chengdu for a variety of reasons, but I am so thrilled about a Worldcon where English will not be the primary language. That thrills me beyond belief.
Finally.
Yeah, like it's truly a world con now.
I mean, China has 1.6 billion people, and a lot of them are science fiction fans. I think Chengdu has like 20 or 30 million inhabitants. That's more than some countries have people. I mean, Finland and New Zealand, both of whom were host countries for Worldcon, have fewer people than the host city for 2020.
I can't even comprehend that quantity of people living in one city. Like, to me, that is like futuristic science fiction, a metropolis of that size.
Yeah, probably very likely looks like that from pictures I've seen. And also it's a very new, it's not a new city there. There was a city there, but it was a small old city. And then
but the construction
sort of
now is fairly new. all the buildings and are fairly new. I know we've got some limited time today, so I wanna come back to talking about classic science fiction. And I know you read and review a lot of classic and retro science fiction and fantasy. With so much new fiction coming out every year, why do you feel older titles are worth reading?
The older titles are, this is where our genre and where we come from. It's our past. And I think it deserves to be remembered, especially since we tend to, at least the institutional memory tends to be very selective. There's a couple of truths which are never questioned until you read the stuff yourself. Things like, Astounding was the best magazine of the 1940s and 50s. Was the absolutely best magazine. John W. Campbell was the best editor. Until you actually read it and think, okay, Astounding published some very, very good work and some classics, and it published a lot of crap. Really, really terrible, unreadable stuff, which is just awful. And other magazines of the period may not have had as many classics. Things like Planet Stories, for example, is remarkably good, even if it has scantily clad women on the cover. Or Weird Tales is very, very consistently good. Good. Or later in the 50s and 60s, Fantastic Stories of the Imagination. This was an excellent magazine, and no one talks about it simply because it hasn't been reprinted. Or other truths like science fiction in the 70s was dull and boring, and then the cyberpunks came along and it became exciting again. Unfortunately, it's wrong, because science fiction in the 70s was not dull and boring at all. There was a lot of women writing, was a feminist science fiction movement. There were a lot of writers of color, and you swallow these truths hook, line, and sinker, and never actually look at them until you look it up and say, wait a minute, but that's wrong. And of course, we also, it's another one I like. Oh, women and people of color didn't write science fiction until, what, 10 years ago or whatever.
Oh, such a falsehood. Such a falsehood.
It's so wrong. They were always also LGBTQ people. They were always there. They are always in the genre, always part of the genre, always writing, just less likely to be reprinted. And sometimes it's like, okay, we will remember one or two people. Like for the Golden Age, we have Lee Brackett and C.L. Moore. We can forget all the other women who were writing then. Then maybe Andre Norton is another one. But that's also simply because she was so very active, very prolific, and had such an extremely long career. Otherwise, she would have been forgotten like the others, I think. And
she published under what was assumed to be a man's name.
Yes, she was assumed to be male. And of course, Lee Brackett and C.L. Moore were also mistaken for male. Also, even they weren't hiding their gender. Well, C.L. Moore was only hiding her identity from her employer because she was afraid she'd get fired, which I totally sympathize with, but they were assumed to be male on the male for, by in letter. That's another thing that's great. Now we can get the actual magazines, at least in scanned form, is that we can read the letter pages. We can see the weirdly goofy advertisements and also just see like what was in the same issue. For example, in the 1930s Weird Tales issue, you suddenly have C.L. Moore, Robert E. Howard, Lovecraft, and Clark Ashton Smith in the same issue. And then there's a little known, lesser known author who's also great. And that's like, okay, because you normally don't see these things. It's great to see them in context. Also, what was published when?
And it's, if you pick up like a C.L. Moore collection now or... a recently printed collection of all of these classic works, you lose the context. And when you see the scans of the originals, that context has to just, does it change how you view that issue when you can see what authors are in the table of contents together? When you have that context, you know, everything from who's in the issue together to letters to the editor to the silly advertisements, does it change how you look at it?
It does, actually, because it's in the context for starters. Some things which might not seem very revolutionary today seem a lot more revolutionary if you see the other stuff it was published alongside. Or also some things which are not quite so great seem a lot less well, they're still not awful. For example, if you have sexism, racism, it's still awful. But let's say there's a lot of, sadly also, not very good stuff and awful stuff. And so in context of like, okay, this is still awful, but it's... But it was surrounded by other. Also, the science fiction ones are not quite so bad. The really bad ones are the adventure pulps and so on. That really has racism issues. And other things, of course, also you get the original illustrations, which are interesting, especially since illustrators tend to miss that characters are quite explicitly described as not white. Right, like, okay, how oftentimes does he have to say, for example, Eric Jan Stark of Lee Brackett's series character, he's not white. He has very, very dark skin. Okay, she came up with this, it's best because he's from Mercury and the solar rays, which is an explanation for having black characters, which George R. R. Martin still used in the 1980s. And I think like, okay, you could have just had to, I understand why she did it, but George, you could have just had the person black. But okay. And it's very explicitly, repeatedly mentioned. And every single cover artist, interior artist for decades drew a white man. I think the first one to actually draw a black man was in the 21st century, a reprint edition.
That's something I hadn't thought of. And seeing that original artwork, you're right. It gives such a different context of... You know, if you're just flipping through the magazine when it was printed and you're just a casual reader and you're flipping through the artwork, you're going to assume that that character is Caucasian.
Yes, because
but he's not.
Illustrating.
He's not.
Also, I mean, Conan, we all know what Conan looks like, but the Conan we think we know is a creation of the 1960s. It was Frank Frazetta's take on Conan, then adopted by the comics and later by the movie. But the Conan in the original stories, he looks mostly he isn't even on the cover at all. Also, a lot of because Margaret Brundage, the Weird Tales cover artist, he preferred drawing women, scantily clad women, often more than one woman, women threatening each other in sexy ways. She very likely was not straight. At least I can't really imagine a straight woman making this artwork. We know a lot of things, but we don't really know about her sexual orientation. If she was not straight, she was probably bisexual. But if she was, she wasn't out. But I think her artwork tells a story. And Conan is, yes, he's a lot less buff and less... he's a lot less buff. He also wears a lot more clothing, actually, since he's not half naked. So yes, it's great to also, I don't know if you see a lot of Asimov characters, they're just guys in suits, literally. It's like, okay, guys in suits. And this is not at all, of course, how we picture these characters today, but yes, it's fast. Finally, I really love the letter columns because it tells us what the first of all, it tells us there were women reading these magazines because women were writing letters. Letters. There were a lot of women and girls. And some of them were very, sometimes you can find these people when you, if you Google them, and you notice that some of them were very young. And also you can see that, for example, if they say like, oh yes, they did not like stories by women. And then you see people, Weird Tales readers gushing about stories by C.L. Moore and Mary Elizabeth Councilman. Man, would they ranked higher than they ranked a Conan story? And it's a good Conan story, but it's and there's one letter from to Weird Tales which is quoted a lot, where Bert something or other, I forgot his surname now, but he had a very unique surname from a place called Freckville in Pennsylvania. So this Bert something or other, he complains about he does not want to read the Little of Laurie stories by C.L. Moore. He has no idea that C.L. Moore is a woman. He really likes Northwest Mist. He really loves Conan. Those are great heroes. He wants more Conan, more Northwest Mist, but no women. Fui. No women in my thing. And he's quoted a lot like, oh, Weird Tales readers did not like women in their magazine.
But it was filled with women writers.
People quoting him never looked up this guy because you can, because I said, okay, who is this guy? It's just one guy. Who is this guy? Can we find out anything about him? And so I Googled him and I found the oft-quoted Weird Tales letter. I found a letter to some kind of amateur radio magazine or some ads in an amateur radio magazine. And I found birth and death dates on an Ancestry website. And the guy was born in 1920. He was 14 years old when he wrote the letter. So here we have a 14-year-old boy who thinks Conan and Northwest Smith, who was, of course, also written by a woman, C.L. Moore, but he didn't know that, are cooler than Hero of Laurie. Okay. We will excuse a 14-year-old for thinking that because he's a 14-year-old boy and probably dreamt of being Conan or Northwest Smith. And he apparently had a lengthy life, which is great for him. So all the best to Bert from Freckville in Pennsylvania, which is great. So yeah, but it's like, okay, why did no one ever try to find out who these people were, especially since you could? Sometimes, I mean, there are people you can't find anymore, but because they have common names or this guy, because we had a name and a place, he was possible to find him.
But that's a very new ability that we have, you know, when these, yeah. It's, I mean, what Ancestry.com and Googling people, that's new in what, the last 20 years.
Yes, we couldn't have done that, of course, if we had read it in the 1990s. Also, it would have been very difficult to have the original pulp. I mean, I live in Germany. We don't get original pulp magazines here. We can get our own pulp magazines, of course, and back issues. But and also an original Weird Tales back issue with a Conan story and probably, and also, for example, this one about with a Little of Laurie, Conan story, Lovecraft story, and a Margaret Brundage cover, that one is going to set you back several hundred dollars or more today if you buy it.
Oh gosh, I'm my brain is going towards digital scans. Like
scans are of course available, but before you could have digital scans and you had to buy the actual issue, then it was extremely expensive. And I think anything unknown is, I think, is extremely expensive. And Astounding is extremely expensive if L. Ron Hubbard had a story in it, because all the Scientologists are buying those up.
They're literally paper magazines.
Yes,
and there's very few. Yeah, they fade, they crumble.
They get thrown out.
They get thrown out. They get recycled. They get wet. It's becoming a physically rare item.
Actually, the internet has saved a lot of these stories. I mean, we would have had Conan and Foundation because they've been reprinted, and Lovecraft and everybody, and even C.L. Moore. But there's so many many stories and authors who have never been reprinted, and would have lost them. And also, we lose a lot of things. There was a German, he's not in science fiction, he was a, well, maybe borderline science fiction, but he was a mystery and detective pulp author, a German one, author, Walter Kabel, and he was extremely prolific in the 1920s, but it was all pulp magazines, so they were very ephemeral. He did not have a lot of paper distribution, and then he had the misfortune of running afoul of the Nazis. He was not Jewish, but I think he had gotten into a fight with Goebbels once or something, so he was banned from writing. His books were burned and almost very, very difficult to find by the 1970s. And he committed suicide soon thereafter because he was banned from writing and did not know how to make money and so on. Very, very sad case. And a lot of the burned books were reprinted after the war, but that was a big name. That was people like Thomas Mann, Leon Feuchtwang, and so on. No one reprinted this guy who wrote detective pulps. But now, many, not all of them, I don't think they have a complete, but you can get most of them online. And that's great, because we're not forgetting this author. Who would have been forgotten otherwise?
And now we can read all of his work.
We can read him, yes. Yeah. We can read him again and say, like, okay, he's good, or he's not good. Or similar for, yes, some of the weird tales published a lot of women. For example, Dorothy Quick, she's great. Wrote wonderful, spooky and spooky stories, and had a great series about reincarnation and past lives, where a woman, she has a quilt, patchwork quilt, and if she touches the different squares of the patchwork quilt, which is made from different old fabric, very, very old, sometimes fabric so old, you're saying, okay, sorry, but you can't make a quilt from 2,000-year-old fabric. But it's a magical quilt, and if she falls asleep and touches one of the squares, she relives the past life of this person, and mostly it's something, some kind of dramatic, romantic, and often, usually it ends in a tragic death, and I think she wrote three of those. They're wonderful, and no one has ever reprinted.
I want to read this. How do I get this? What
it's
issue is
online,
this in?
Actually, you can, if you use, they're an unknown, and it's on, those you can get on archive.org, or probably Gutenberg also has them, but Gutenberg doesn't like Germans, or at least it doesn't like our, yes, it doesn't, Gutenberg doesn't like Germans, or at least it doesn't like our government, and blocked all Germans because of copyright issue. The copyright copyright for three German authors. The estate sued Gutenberg, and the judge said those books are still under copyright. It's three authors, only three. And they're out of copyright in other countries. And Gutenberg, instead of blocking Germans from those books, they blocked all Germans from everything on the site and say, like, write to your congressman. Yes, maybe I would, but I don't have a congressman, and I have a member of parliament, and I'm pretty sure he has no idea what I'm talking about. Also, sorry, our copyright is life plus 50. Yes, one of them either has run out or will run out this year, but the other two are still there. They died sometime in the 1950s.
So
maybe in 5 years we can use it again.
So archive.org you recommend?
Yes, that archive.org has a lot of scans of pulp magazines. Okay, the copyright is occasionally iffy, but if the story has never been reprinted, I'm not stealing from anybody, but keeping it alive. Gutenberg also has a lot of pulp reprints. If you can get in, and if they don't say, like, oh, we hate your government, because we were violating the copyright laws. Also, those books were, let's say, the books which a lot of students read. So it was, those books were valuable. That was taking someone's money. This was lost reading Lost Weird Tales or unknown author doesn't really take anybody's money away because they're not being reprinted. Oh yes, it's another one. Alison V. Harding. She was one of the top 10 contributors to Weird Tales. A woman writer. We know almost nothing about her. There's a hint that it was a pen name. She wrote amazing horror stories about machinery coming to life and industrial horror, like a terrible. The one I really loved was about an elevated train in New York City, which did not like elevated trains being taken down and took terrible revenge.
I want to read that story. Like, yeah, don't get me wrong.
It's linked on my. I reviewed it, and I will put the link in if I reviewed that one. And it was wonderfully atmospheric, and she was really, really great. She was very prolific, and we know almost nothing about her because the people who researched her tales had like, okay, we're like Howard Lovecraft, Clark Ashton Smith. We maybe like C.L. Moore. We don't like the stuff from the 1940s. Lovecraft and Howard were dead. We don't care about that. So it's uninteresting. I think one of the Weird Tales scholars literally said, like, oh, this is just stuff that fills pages. And so it's so great, these great stories. And so this is why things get forgotten, because some early anthologist or scholar says, oh, I don't like this. Which is, of course, legitimate, but it's a problem not to like something, but it's a problem if no one else.
Right, we shouldn't.
It's never reprinted.
Right, those stories shouldn't be lost to history because some critic said 60 years ago, meh, not my thing.
Yeah. I mean, if you were to ask me, we would probably have lost a lot of Heinlein because I'm not a Heinlein fan. And this would be a pity for the genre. But luckily, I'm not the critic who decides what gets. And generally, I think like, okay, let's keep as much of it alive as possible, so people can revisit it, even if not all of it is good and good, and some of it is of purely historical interest, but not really enjoyable anymore.
But if you enjoy supernatural stories, you're going to be able to find something supernatural.
Yes, of course, it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
This is another problem, the anti-fantasy bias in the science fiction genre, which affected us for a very long time. It also meant that a lot of great fantasy stories were lost. Lost, of course, of the big names, names were reprinted, but a lot of the lesser-known fantasy stories, I mean, Isaac Asimov did Martin Greenberg. They did this very good. This is very important in solidly about the Golden Age year by year. And they almost always, you could always pick Retro Hugo fine because everybody had those anthologies. A lot of people didn't read the original magazines.
But they read the anthologies.
That's anthology.
Yeah.
And yeah, some of the stories, they were huge. Not all stories were good. I mean, Deadline by Cliff Cartmell, I know it's of historical interest, but it's a terrible, terrible story. And really, wouldn't say it deserves to be forgotten, but it's a historical curiosity. It's nothing that should be. It's nothing that really has any value beyond the historical curiosity. It's a bad story, and it would have been bad in the 1940s. But it was bad in the 1940s. It was just famous because it contains this handy primer on how to build an atomic bomb, Asimov famously, he did not like Weird Tales, so he simply didn't print any stories from Weird Tales. He did like Unknown, but he would have printed some from Unknown, but he didn't like Weird Tales, and he didn't like Planet Stories, so stories from Planet Stories or Thrilling Wonder Stories rarely made the cut, and he thought Astounding was great, Campbell was great, of course they were publishing him, Campbell was publishing him and was nurturing him. So we get a very reductive view of the science fiction of the era if you only look at those anthologies, which is basically, you could say something like, oh, this is the best of Astounding of the 1940s, would be fine. Nothing wrong with that. But
but he named it, you know, the best science fiction.
Yes,
and people
the best science fiction of the Golden Age and that it's not. It's missing a lot. And so the fact that we're missing pretty much of the history of the fantasy genre is really a pity because it's just we have some efforts in the 19th. We have Lynn Carter, who was not a good writer. And I reviewed a story by a novel by him for Galactic Journey. And it was, yes, was very, very funny about was, but not intentionally, but he was a great editor and he saved a lot of early fantasy from the early 20th and late 19th century. But we're missing a lot of the stuff from the 1930s, 40s, 50s because it wasn't reprinted. They reprinted, okay, they reprinted Conan and they reprinted Lovecraft. They reprinted some of the C.L. Moore stories. The big things were reprinted, but
nothing else.
The whole, but the whole horror, a lot of gothic horror stories, also a lot of proto-urban fantasy. I also assumed like urban fantasy is something that showed up in the mid 1980s when Charles Delint, but it's not. We have predecessors to these stories, stories 50 years earlier, only that we haven't read them because no one has bothered to reprint them.
I'm Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Our guest today is Hugo nominee Cora Boulard. And you yourself are involved in a really important anthology project to reprint. Yes, those the beautiful Rediscovery anthology.
Rediscovery, science fiction by women. We have volume one, which covers 1958 to 1963, and volume two covers 1953 to 1957. And those are, the editor is Gideon Marcus of Galactic Journey. And the idea is to pick great stories by women, because Gideon also noticed that there were a lot of women writing science fiction in the 1950s and 1960s and writing very good stories, but women who were forgotten, sometimes due to death or having very brief careers and just vanishing after a few stories, sometimes just due to bias. And he thought like, yes, let's reprint some of those great stories by women which are forgotten. And there's always an accompanying essay for every of those stories. And I wrote two of those essays for both volumes. And a lot of other great people wrote essays. We have a lot of, we have Kat Rambo, we have Lisa Jastrzek, I think that's how she pronounces her name, who's a science fiction scholar at Georgia Tech University, I think is the name. We have Alyssa Winans, who's a Hugo finalist, and Lorelei Esther, another Hugo finalist and the youngest one ever, and a lot of other great women who are introducing those, mostly women who are introducing those stories.
Very exciting. What a wonderful project.
Yes, it's great. Also, most of those are not the stories which have been reprinted like umpteen times. There are well-known authors in here. I mean, we have Carol Emshwiller. We have, let's get the list. Yes, we have Miriam Ellen DeFord. We have Catherine McLean, Judith Merrill. Those, we have Lee Brackett. Those, we have Margaret Sinclair. Those authors at least have been reprinted. But a lot of their stuff has never been reprinted, and it's mostly lesser. So it's not the umpteenth version of That Only a Mother, no matter how wonderful the story is, or not the umpteenth reprint of one of the Eric John Stark stories, no matter how wonderful they are, but it's mostly lesser known stories.
Oh, Only a Mother is like my favorite in
I
volume
love that
one.
Story. It's wonderful. But Lee Brackett Judith Merrill wrote so many other great stories, which are also, I think, worth remembering. And so it's great because you won't have a problem finding a reprint of That Only Mother. It's one of the, it's a very, very, because there have been other projects to reprint vintage science fiction by women, but often they focus on the very, very famous stories. For example, for C.L. Moore, they usually use Chamblot. Chamblot is a great story. I love it, but it's a wonderful story.
It's a wonderful story. I've read it five times. I want to read more.
30 times. I really don't think it needs another reprint because you can find it. I'd much rather see something reprinted which has never been reprinted.
Mm-hmm, same. I don't get me wrong, I love seeing familiar names in a table of contents, but I want to read something by those authors that I've never read before. And this Rediscovery anthology series lets me do that.
Yes, you can read a lot of, I did the introduction for a Lee Brackett story. So, and I think my introduction actually started with, do we actually need to rediscover Lee Brackett because we know who she is? But the story I was a, it's called The Queer Ones from 1953, and it's a little reprinted story. It had, I think, the last reprint was sometime in the 70s. So it's a little remembered, little reprinted story, and a very good story about, which has things to say about, interestingly, about illegal immigration. And also, yes, it's a story. I mean, early Lee Brackett from the 40s, 50s, she was very much a social justice warrior type. She wrote about colonialism, imperialism, all these things which you say like, oh, I mean, we've all heard Janet Ings' speech of yes, and the white and colonialist science fiction. And of course, the Golden Age science fiction and Campbell, she was specifically addressing Campbell. Yes, Campbell was publishing a lot of it. He was also publishing some stories which were not like that, which I always wonder, like, how did they slip through? Were they just so good that he had to print them, or was he asleep that week and his assistant let them through? But of course, if you look in other magazines, you find it very different, and you find a lot of criticism of colonialism, imperialism. Lee Brackett is quite strident often in this criticism, and has her social. Yes, I mean, it's all set on Mars, and we wouldn't do it like this today. And also, for example, if whenever we say like, oh, no one ever writes fantasy set in Africa and based on African culture. Yes, Charles Saunders was doing this in the 70s. And we kind of forgot he existed. He had problems he had publication problems. And there was also a problem that they marketed his character as a Black Tarzan, a character who was more a Conan type, something Imaro, and actually quite different also from Conan. He was, but they had this marketing tagline, the Black Tarzan, and the Burroughs estate sued them, and they had to pulp the entire print run. So he had marketing problems, timing problems, and yes, we were just about to remember to rediscover him and reprint him, remember he existed around the time he died, which is a pity. But this is also, yes, it's simply important to remember there always were women, there always were people of color writing, there always were those people of color. It's often not easy to tell because we don't know a lot about a lot of authors. Also, pulp authors lie. There are people who talk about them, oh, I'm the descendant of Mexican grandees, and then you find out they're actually the descendant of Jewish immigrants from New Jersey or something. Both of which is fine, but it changes the context. Or the guy who was the guy who claimed to be Arabic and was really a Greek immigrant from Nebraska or something like that. So a lot of them actually take their bios with a grain of salt because they were very good liars.
And it's I mean, these are authors; they get paid to lie.
Yeah, they get paid to lie, and they came up with great story. I mean, the stories are still good, but at least that's why it's difficult to figure out. Out unless you have a photo and have more information to figure out who was a person of color and who was not, because simply if we don't know anything about those people, we don't know.
Right, we don't have a photo. We don't even know what their real names were.
Yeah, there are people where I really have no idea. There are authors where I have no idea, and I've tried to find them, and I have no idea who they were if they had a really common name.
Interesting. I can feel just all the fascination like growing in my brain thanks to this conversation.
Yes, it's really fun. I just found it fun to dig. And also, I don't, because we know that the reactionary elements in our genre, the set and Rabbit Puppy, they have some imaginary golden age when science fiction was great. They are not quite sure when it was. Anything from before 1937 to before 1985, sometimes 1998. It's usually either whenever they stopped publishing what I like, or whenever I grew up and everything wasn't so new and fresh anymore. And they have a very, very reductive view of the past of the genre, which is completely wrong, even if you're only cursorily familiar with it. But I don't want to leave the past of our genre to these people. I mean, the terrible people of Castalia House, of Vox Day's outfit, on their blog, they review vintage science fiction from the pulp magazines. And I really don't want to leave it to them, too, because you know what, that they will take the completely wrong conclusions from everything.
Yeah, they shouldn't. No one group should own those opinions.
It's there. The books are there. The stories are there. Read them. Look at them. You will be surprised. Not all of it is of course. Some things will make you uncomfortable. Some things make me uncomfortable. If there's a case like, okay, I'll give you the blue black bat. I'm okay with you calling them Hemites. That's people in the Conan stories. But did you really have to throw in the hook nose? No, please. We don't want. I don't really need this anti-Semitism right now. But all really terrible descriptions of. So yeah, there's stuff there which is not good. And there also are simply stories which are forgotten for a reason because mm-hmm. they were not very good.
And you know,
and stories which survived even though they were not very good, which is even more surprising.
Yeah, stories that are terrible. I personally am okay with those being lost to history. Give our listeners some great recommendations. What authors and short stories and novels that most people may not be familiar with? What do you recommend?
Okay, well, first of all, anything by Dorothy Quick is well worth reading. She was she's mostly remembered these days because when Dorothy Quick was 11, she met Mark Twain on a steamboat. He was in his 80s, and Mark Twain, he didn't like little girls like that. He just thought, okay, there's a cute little girl, and he was scared of the big, was a center wheeler stern boat, a steamboat. There's a photo of them on the steamboat, and so he told her about steamboats, and she told him that she liked to write, and he encouraged her. And she did have a lengthy writing career for the pulps. Not just she wrote for the science fiction, she wrote for Weird Tales and Unknown, but she also wrote for romance, pulps, and so on, which are almost never reprinted. You not even scanned. So that is a whole genre which is lost. And she was great. She's the one who wrote the story about the patchwork quilt. And she also wrote a lot of gothic fantasy. It's probably the work by her at Gutenberg, or you can just go to archive.org and look up old issues of Weird Tales. Then we have Alison V. Harding. There actually is a collection of her stories, which was reprinted, I think, in 2020 or 2021. So she has had a reprint, but she's never had one before who wrote this great industrial-style modern horror stories about haunted machinery, which was a thing in the 1940s. They were apparently very scared of machinery because you have a lot of haunted machinery. Killdozer by Theodore Sturgeon, it's a very famous one. Or The Twonky by C.L. Moore and Henry Kuttner, and I think it was Louis Paget. It was one of their pen names. Oh yeah, she's also great. Margaret Sinclair is another. She was extremely versatile, lived for a very long time and had a lengthy career. Her last publication was sometime in the early 1980s, and she started in the mid-40s. She wrote space opera and science fiction. She wrote very, very versatile things. She wrote a story about a trans woman in 1962. An actual story, and it's not one of those magical sex change things. It's an actual trans woman who had gender reassignment surgery. Okay, it's not the way we would. The story is called Roberta, and it came out in 1962 I think it was Galaxy. I would have to look it up now. And she also mentions the word abortion in the story, which is
that's a shocker.
Quite shocking in 1962 when it was almost completely illegal everywhere. And let's say it's not the way we would say a story, we would write the story today. But it was a story written in 1962 about a trans woman and about trying to get away from her dad name and her others and her former self, and it's a great. I think it's wonderful that the story exists, and it's a pity if we forgot that Margaret Sinclair was writing about trans women. She was a Quaker and a Wiccan. I had no idea this was possible, but apparently it is. Yes, and she wrote a lot about supernatural and about Wiccans, and she's actually listed in the infamous Appendix N of the original Dungeons and Dragons, which. Yes, she is listed. They often say like, oh, she's the least known author on Appendix N. I say, well, some of the others are a bit more obscure, I think. But she's one of the more obscure ones. But of course, if you're listed in Appendix N, you at least will get reprinted because a lot of people are looking those up.
That's become an encyclopedia, Appendix
yes,
N.
Yes, it's. Jeffrey Johnson, who did the also Sad Puppies, who did this Appendix N read through and was nominated for Hugo, and I thought like, okay, he's reviewing books. That's nice. He's not just yelling about culture war. Well, okay, he's kind of wrong on all of those books. And what is Appendix N anyway? Oh, it's the Dungeons and Dragons. Let's look it up. What is this? Oh, it's a list of books. Hey, those are pretty good books, actually. So, yes. Of course, you don't have to listen to Jeffrey Johnson. Johnson, if you want to learn about Appendix N, there are a lot of other people doing read-throughs and discussions who are a lot better.
There are some wonderful discussions going on currently and in the last couple of years. So anybody
it's covered.
It has. So it's there's so many wonderful resources now. I'm just so happy to be alive right now and have archive.org and be able to look people up and have all these anthologies that are coming out and have stories that I've never heard of being reprinted. Like I feel very fortunate to be alive right now.
Yes, me too. I mean, I remember how difficult it was to find many of those stories when I, especially not living in the US, where a lot of things were not, were pretty much limited to whatever the local import bookstore had. They had a lot of classic science fiction. That's how I could find Edgar Rice Burroughs and Isaac Asimov. Not all of them, but I could find some. But for example, Lee Brackett and Cecil Moore were extremely difficult to find. Because whoever reprinted them didn't export them.
Oh, I wish.
And so I literally scoured used bookshops in different continents to get some of those books.
I wish we had been pen pals when we were kids. I would have just shipped you a box of.
That would have been wonderful. I have a lot of. I still come home with a lot of books, but not as many anymore, simply because a lot of things are now easier to find. I can just go to Amazon and buy them or get them directly from the publisher, download them in archive.org. I don't have to go to the used bookstore and hope that they have with a lengthy list. I really had a lengthy printed list. I've ditched. It's probably still on the computers in some form, but it hasn't survived the last few computer upgrades simply because it's no longer really that important to do it. And of course, also they were hugely imported books were hugely expensive because the import fees $1. I still pay, before the switch to a trade paperback, I paid about less for a new paperback than I paid in the 1980s when I was a kid with a small allowance, and a paperback was a huge investment. It could eat up a month's allowance.
Yeah.
It was so expensive.
If you come across a book that you're looking for and you can't find it, or you want a paperback and it's just not being exported, let me know.
Yeah,
I will. I can track it down. The state, I live in Michigan, and we are famous here for just amazing used bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
And I will.
Yeah,
I'm happy to ship you a box of books.
Yeah, wonderful. I might take you up on that simply because a lot of the older paperbacks are still very difficult to find because anything that came out basically before 2000 or late 90s is difficult because it was before the internet.
I need an excuse to go to the famous huge used bookstore in Detroit, John King Books, and they specialize in old paperbacks. So send me your list.
That sounds amazing. I would have to take a suitcase in there and take an extra suitcase out. I mean, that's actually what I did when I was in May. We were in New England, Boston, and driving up to Maine in the late 1980s. And there were also lots of used bookstores in Maine, including a huge one in an old barn. And I literally had a big box of books and just shipped them home, and then had to show up at the customs office because it was. And I was like, oh, I'm a poor student. I need those books for my studies. And the customs officer was like, okay, yeah, take them.
I don't want to go through your suitcase.
Yeah, he was like, I don't really want to look at those blows. Well, he opened them up, saw it was really books. I mean, it could have been drugs or shoes.
No, it's just paperbacks. It's all books.
But it was just, he just saw it was old books. And yeah. I said, like, oh, I'm a student. I need those for my project and my exams. And he said, okay, take them. Probably because he really had no interest in going through old books trying to figure out what they're worth.
It is very easy for me to ship a box of books to anywhere on the planet. So any mailing address on planet Earth, just send me your list. And
I will probably take you up on that.
I will take any excuse to go shopping for books. And then I can send them to someone who will enjoy them. And I win and you win. So as we're wrapping up, can you tell us once more your websites, if you have social media, like can we find you on Twitter? Where can our listeners find you on the internet?
Okay, well, you can find me at www.corabulot.com. Sorry, that's corabulert.com. Yeah. I have to slow down on spelling my name because I've had to do it so often. And then you can find me about once a month at galacticjourney.org, where you can also find a link to purchase those great anthologies I just held up, which you can get at any bookstore of your choice, but you can also buy them directly via Journey Press, the publisher. And you can find me on Twitter under at Cora Bulat. That's again CoraBulert. And yes, I have a story coming up in the Longlist Anthology Volume 7, edited by David Steffen, which should be out sometime soon. And I also have a story coming up in Rogues in the House Present, A Book of Blades, edited by Matt John and Logan Whitney, which should be coming out, well, I've been told very, very soon, so I will simply assume it comes very soon. And yes, I just had a story published, a flash fiction story published on the website of Wingraf magazine. That's WYNGRAF magazine, their new magazine of cozy fantasy, and they publish flash fiction on their website. I just had one come out yesterday, and their first issue, which doesn't have a story by me, should I think goes becomes available today or tomorrow. So yes, that's where you can find me, or where you can find some upcoming fiction by me.
Cora, thank you so much for spending some time with me today. It was my absolute pleasure to get to talk with you.
Yes, thank you. It was a pleasure for me as well. And I'm great to be on Retro Rockets podcast.
Thank you so much.
The Retro Rockets podcast explores the deep heritage of vintage and classic science fiction and fantasy. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our show is recorded, mixed, and produced by Andy Robbins. John Wenger is our special consultant. Our music is by Meter through a Creative Commons license, and Carolyn Baker designed our logo. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time on Retro Rockets. Thank you.